So we're starting a little new mini-series. I don't know how long, it'll probably only two sermons, but and it's called Hollywood. And I was trying to figure out what series to do, what's something new to do, a book or something like that. And all these people kept on talking to me about movies and invited me to a movie and this movie and that movie. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to talk about movies. I'm going to talk about Hollywood and its influence and how Christians should approach things like movies and TV shows and things like that. And I have a very simple purpose with this sermon. If you don't remember anything from this sermon, this is the one thing I want you to walk away from, is that movies are very powerful modes of communication, and they're very influential. And there is all sorts of messages coming in from movies that you might not even be aware that you are being affected by. And that is absolutely essential to know. And this whole sermon will be to defend that thesis. Now, I have a little clip that I'm going to show you just what you can do with media and how you can change a message. So we'll just have that now. Now, if you've never seen Mary Poppins, it might not be as funny. But Mary Poppins isn't a horror film, right? Mary Poppins is a very children-friendly movie, and But here's the thing: with media, you can take anything and make it say anything if you're a good enough filmmaker. So you can take any idea, anything, and just change it. You could easily take. You know, if someone was really good, they could go online, download a bunch of my sermons, cut and paste all sorts of things, put it together, and I could be, you know, a raving, satanic, worshiping, you know, frog-eating, crazy person, for all I know, because of the crazy things I say in sermons. Right? Because that media is very powerful. It's very, And so, images... You know, do you have the phrase a picture says a thousand words? Do you have that? It's very true. Images are concrete expressions, often of very abstract ideas, of all sorts of ideas. I think we love media. We love stories, we love pictures, we love music, we love all this sort of stuff, because, I mean, it's often much easier to communicate what we want to say, how we feel through those mediums, right? I mean, how many of us, I mean, I don't know, it's hard to just lay everything out in propositions, right? Imagine if your relationship with your partner was just based on propositions, and there was you never bought flowers, you never sang songs, you never went to dinner, you never, you know, went to movies, you never did anything. If you were just like, hello, partner, I feel this today. Like, we don't work in propositions. And you know what's really cool is the Bible itself is not a series of propositions. You know, the Bible isn't just believe this, believe this, believe this. The Bible, what's it full of? What's it full of? Yes. Stories! Yes, stories. Because stories are probably the best way to communicate truth. Not the best way to communicate truth, but it's the most common way to communicate truth. And what are the most popular forms of storytelling today? Movies, TV shows. These things are constantly, we spend so much time watching movies, and every movie you watch, every show you watch, everything you watch has a worldview, has a message it's trying to sell you. And, you know, I was trying to, I didn't calculate it, but just to take an example, anyone ever watch the series 24? Anyone know that? Yeah. Okay, so 24, it's there's 24 episodes in every season of 24. What's 24 times 8? Who's the good at math here? 24 times 8. 192? 192, okay. That's 192 hours of my life wasted, okay? So 192 hours, okay? And what do I do? Here on Sunday, I give you a sermon for a half hour. So what's 192 times 2? What's that? 384. Okay, so just the one show, by having watched the whole, all eight seasons of 24, you know, that is a lot of sermon time. That is a long time for a message to be, and 24 has a message, right? It has a lot of messages that are very interesting. And that is a long time to be constantly bombarded. And odds are, everyone here spends more time being influenced by movies and TV shows and YouTube clips and all that sort of stuff than you do Christian things. You know, and a lot of you just come on a Sunday morning. You don't have your own Bible time or whatever. So you only gain a half hour here. And then you go out, you watch 8 hours of media during the week. What do you think is going to influence you more? Right? I mean, so we need to be very careful as we watch movies. And just so people know, the movies that we're going to show up here, I'm not necessarily endorsing them. That's one thing. And second, I'm not saying you shouldn't watch movies. Rather, I'm saying we should watch movies more critically. And we're going to go and talk about that. Okay. So, movies are one of the modern world's most strongest examples of storytelling, right? And so when you watch a movie, you are watching a story that is kind of an incarnation, is kind of a mini microcosm of a worldview. And the hero in the story always embodies the superior worldview, and the villain always embodies the inferior worldview. And the drama of the story, right, comes with the conflict between the hero and the villain. And by the end of the story, the hero's worldview is proven superior to the villain's. And so you always see this. Now, a good example of the power of technology is a good example of the power of image to embody otherwise rational argumentation is The Exorcism of Emily Rose. Has anyone seen this movie? Anyone? Not a single person? I use this movie to scare people. It's a very, very fascinating movie. Writer and director Scott Derrickson tells the story of a Roman Catholic priest on trial for criminal negligence in the death of a college girl named Emily Rose. And Emily had come to the priest because she believed she was demon-possessed. And in the midst of a laborious exorcism ritual, she died from self-inflicted wounds. And the protagonist of the story is this lawyer girl. Her name's Erin Bruner. And she's a spiritual agnostic. In the whole story, she's kind of this agnostic who serves as the priest's defense attorney. And throughout the trial, right, the prosecutor, who they get is a Christian guy, prosecutor mocks her attempt to prove the possibility of demon possession, because it's the only way she's going to get this priest off, that demon possession is actually true. And so he argues that such superstitious arguments are unbecoming, right, of the legal profession. And he attempts to argue that Emily had epilepsy, and he attempts to prove, which she then required medication for, and it wasn't voodoo that basically caused her to die. And what's very fascinating about this movie, and what I really like about it, is it presents both sides of the argument so equally that the story leaves Brunner, the agnostic, it leaves her unsure. She's still not sure by the end of the movie. And the viewer is left with a strong openness towards the legitimacy of a spiritual world, having been shown in raw experience a demon possession. In contrast to the rationalization of, you know, of the scientific world that we live in. And it's very, there's all these arguments. The whole movie is an argument trying to show, okay, what's the scientific explanation for this? Is there a spiritual explanation? It's this whole argument, and it's absolutely fascinating. Derrickson, the director, uses the story as a metaphor for the stranglehold of modernity on the Western mind, right? And the inadequacy of always of the rationalism and the scientific method in discovering all truth. And so what this movie is arguing is that you can't learn everything through the scientific method. And that's the message of the movie. And you know what? Most people will watch this movie and they'll just be like, wow, man, notice how her hair went back and it was cool and she was like scratching things, man. Yeah. And yet the whole movie is teaching a very important lesson, and that they're picking up that you're picking up subconsciously, right? There's a message. The director had a purpose. And if you're just watching the movie and not paying attention, you might be influenced in a way that you don't realize. Movies, rather often than making strictly logical arguments, though, about truth or reality, a story carries us along with it, right? And we get really caught up into the story. And if the audience likes the protagonist, if you're watching the movie and you like the hero, if you identify with them in some way, and you follow them on their journey and learn the lessons they learn, this is why it's so important then for you to be discerning about who you're rooting for. Because there's a lot of movies out there where the good guy is really a bad guy, right? Have you ever seen movies like that where really did anyone ever watch the movie I can't remember the name to? Good. right. There's lots of movies where it's very popular right now to have characters that are gray. Right? You know, if you watch older movies from the 50s, the 60s, the good characters are good and the bad characters are bad. Right? But now, Batman, is he good? Is he bad? Wolverine, is he good? Is he bad? Spider-Man, is he good? They're conflicted. They're gray. But you're cheering for them. And you're cheering, and then you unbecomingly start to think that gray is good. And that good is bad. And that bad is closer to gray. Right? And it's you're watching these, and you slowly get influenced. And there's many ways that stories create a connection between the audience and the protagonist in order to persuade you to follow whatever that hero is like. You know, one is through sympathy. Many people love to root for the underdog. My favorite movie, I don't know why it's my favorite movie, it just is my favorite movie, is Rudy. Anyone ever see Rudy? I will say a movie that someone has seen. People saw Mary Poppins, though, right? Okay. So, right, Rudy is about this guy who is like my size, literally. He's more buff. And he wants to play football for Notre Dame, right? He wants to play football. Can you imagine me, basically playing football for Notre Dame is almost the equivalent of me playing rugby for like the University of Auckland or, you know, the All Blacks or something. Like, no, right? There's no way I'm someone in my shape. But he has this plan, this determination to play football for Notre Dame. But the problem is Notre Dame's also a good academic school, and he's not a very good academic. So he's small, and he's not an academic, but he wants to play football for Notre Dame. And the movie Rudy is about his attempt, his journey to try to play football for Notre Dame. And what it does is it makes you want to cheer for him. It makes you want to cheer for the things that he's trying to accomplish. And so his all the things he's doing, you resonate with. And the movie does a very good job of that. So movies love us to try to get us to join with the protagonist by cheering for the underdog, or cheering for the hero who has suffered some great injustice. Humor is another way, right, to draw us into the worldview. Anyone watch The Daily Show or the Colbert Report? Maybe the young people here. Do you even know that you know the show I'm talking about? The Daily Show? Does anyone know The Daily Show? Right. He's Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert. They use humor to convey their points. They make very strong political claims. They make very strong points, and they get you to laugh about them, and it makes it much easier then for you to agree with them. It makes it much easier for you to agree with them. So they use humor. Audiences love to laugh. Likeability, Movies will make the character likable so that you agree with them. People will like a protagonist even if he is a criminal. Right? They'll like him even if he is a criminal. Oh, that reminds me of Payback. That was the movie I was thinking. Payback with Mel Gibson. He is a bad guy. He's ruthless. He's a horrible person. A horrible, horrible, horrible person. But even in the trailers, it says, you'll root for the bad guy. Right? And you do. By the end of the movie, you're like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And you're cheering. At the end of the movie, you're cheering for someone who's like just killing people. For like nothing. And, right? And that's the power of movies. And remember, my whole thesis today is just to tell you that movies have power. They have the power to convince you, unbeknownst to you. Okay, so another way technology fails us. Okay, yeah, okay, subversion. Okay, subversion, what's subversion? Subversion is the retelling of one mythology in terms of another, rhetorical, in the terms of another. So the film Underworld uses the accepted mythologies of Romeo and Juliet and the horror genre of vampires and werewolves to address the controversial idea of interracial romance. Right? That is one of the messages of the movie, right? The tribal families of vampires and werewolves have been feuding for centuries, killing each other in the dark of night. And along comes a hybrid vampire-werewolf thing that threatens the werewolf's sense of identity, right? And the vampire's power over the werewolves. And the hybridization of these two cultures threatens the power of the majority and the survival of the minority. And utilizing these other mythologies bypasses the deep-seated prejudices of viewers to address the thorny issue of racism. Right? If they just made a movie about, you know, just about racism, no one would want to see it. But you make a movie about vampires and werewolves and use this to show the conflict, and you can address a lot of important issues. You know, the scriptures themselves use subversion. It's a very important, powerful technique. The Apostle John, for example, subverts the Hellenistic doctrine of the Logos in John 1. In the beginning was the Word. Well, the Word meant something very different before Christianity. The Word was this sort of pantheistic worship of reason. It was this idea that there was this reason was guiding everything. And John takes that term and says, no, it's not reason, it's Christ who's the creator and sustainer of all. Or right at the beginning of the Gospel of Mark, the Gospel of Mark subverts the word gospel. You know, gospel means good news. Well, what did that word mean before the Christians used it? It meant good news, victory on the battlefield. You had victory on the battlefield, so you would proclaim the good news. And what the Christians did, it says, no, good news isn't Caesar having victory on the battlefield. Good news is Christ having victory over sin. That's real good news. And so this idea of subversion is a very powerful idea. It's in the scriptures, and it's in movies all the time. Right? And if you watch completely uncritically, if you take the approach that movies are just entertainment, and it's very dangerous, because movies, I mean, they are entertainment, but they're also trying to give you a worldview, and you need to be aware of that. You need to engage with that. Another way movies try to convince you of a message is by analogy. And an analogy is an inference that if two things are similar in some ways, they are similar in other ways as well. And so in movies, images that embody a similarity between ideas connect those ideas in identity. For example, the movie The Island. Anyone see The Island? Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. Okay, good. Okay. Anyway, so the Island is this futuristic sci-fi story that about a corporate story. I'm kind of ruining a little bit of it, but you had 10 years to see it. Okay. So The Island is this futuristic sci-fi story about a corporation that creates clones, right, to harvest body parts for clients as needed, right? And the clones are kept in isolation and in ignorance of their true identity. And the corporation uses euphemisms for the clones that they're products so as to dehumanize them. And the corporation tries to kill the clones before they are discovered. And henchmen make their way through a series of clones suspended in large plastic bags, right? And they look like fetuses in amniotic sacs. It's very It's kind of gross, actually. And these clones are infected with drugs, and the plastic sacks are slashed open. A black man challenges the owner of the corporation, suggesting that that this is how slaves were treated in early American history. And through all this, through all this whole movie, all the images that are being shown on the screen, the director, the makers of the movie, are reminding us of things like abortion and euthanasia, the Jewish Holocaust, and black slavery. These are all messages that are coming out in the movie, The Island, just to reminding you of these things that cause you to start to think the way the director does about those issues. And analogy is often used in Scripture. Right, you know, the evil of the beast in the biblical book Revelation is analogized in his many-headed, blaspheming and animalistic, flesh-eating nature, while the sacrificial and peaceful nature of the lamb depicts Christ's purity and goodness. Or, for example, Nathan's parable, the King David analogizes his murder of Uriah to a man stealing another man's only lamb. And so analogy is a very powerful tool. It's all over the Scriptures, and it's in movies all the time. And again, what is the point? The sermon is purely, the point is, I'm trying to convince you that movies are powerful storytelling tools that are used to convince you of a message. And if you just watch it uncritically, you might not be aware that you are being convinced. And I'm not saying all movies are bad. I'm not saying all movies are good. I'm just saying that as Christians, we need to watch movies and shows and everything with a discerning, critical eye. The next thing is generalization that is often used. Generalization is usually considered a logical fallacy, but because it takes a particular example of something and generalizes it to a universal, when in fact this is not always true. But the fact that not everyone of a cultural community is exactly the same does not disprove, though, that there are, in fact, many who are, right? And so what often happens is movies use generalizations to help you identify what community a character is a part of, right? So in a story, placing common phrases into a character's mouth or common behaviors in their actions identifies them with a certain cultural community, and the character becomes the symbol for that community, right? And the more common phrases... Oh, I got a question. Okay, I'll answer that in a second. Interesting question. So, and the character becomes a symbol for that community. And the more common phrases and behaviors displayed in the character, the more easily universalized they are. Right? So the villain in The Island is the head of a corporation. Okay? And he explains his motivations using the familiar language of, you know, early 20th century scientists. The clones have no souls, and they're a means to good ends for society, such as the curing of diseases like leukemia. And early 20th century scientists made similar arguments to justify the public funding for things like eugenics. Do you know what eugenics is? Did you have that here? In the particular province I'm from, in Canada, we were heavy into eugenics. And eugenics is where you basically treat humans like cattle. So the people you don't want to reproduce, you castrate them. You make sure that they can't produce. So if you were mentally ill, or you were of a, or even the natives, so our version of the Maori, they were made sterile so that they couldn't reproduce. And that was a very popular movement in the early 20th century. And so by placing the familiar language of the eugenics movement in the villain's mouth, the storyteller makes a general connection of those ideas with villainy. And this may not seem fair or logical to those who disagree, but it's the nature of storytelling to embody a worldview or paradigm in its characters. For example, there was in the movie Kingdom of Heaven. Has anyone seen that movie, Kingdom of Heaven? It's about the Crusades. And in that movie, there was not one good Christian character. Every Christian character is a loser. Okay, they're either the enemy or they're just a loser. Right, and so that you watch that and you start to get the idea that Christians are losers, are enemies. Who are the good characters? The good characters are the Muslims, and the good characters in particular are the spiritual agnostics, are those who are just like, whatever. That's the good character. That's Orlando Bloom, the good-looking good character, right, in the movie. And so you're watching that movie, and by the end, you are resonating more with the worldview of Orlando Bloom as opposed to any of the Christian characters. And then we get to, I got another question. This is exciting. Okay. Symbolism. And I'll get to those questions in a moment. Symbolism. In a story, a character may become a symbol for a particular worldview, and the consequences of that character's experience becomes a symbol for what that worldview leads to. And a very classic example of this is Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Has anyone seen this one? Who here liked the original more? Everyone who put up their hand who saw this one. So, okay. Right, okay, yeah. I like the original more, but I like the music from this one more. So, I put my cards on the table. So in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, or in the book, or what have you, the five different kids who win tickets to tour Willy Wonka's factory become symbols of the negative results that different types of parenting bring, right? A suburban overachiever shows the perils of hyper-competition. A fat German boy serves as a symbol of consumption, right? A spoiled little rich girl gets everything she asks for by whining. And a video game enthusiast embodies antisocial behavior. And of course, there's Charlie, whose poor but loving family sacrifices their needs for his happiness. And so the storyteller communicates his view of what parenting should really be like through children as symbols of different approaches. Right? And, you know, and this is also in the Bible. In his letter to Galatians, the Apostle Paul allegorizes Hagar and Sarah as symbols for Jews in bondage to the law and Christians as two children of Abraham. Jerusalem and Mount Zion itself are frequently used as symbols for the church or the people of God. And so symbols are often used all over Scripture because Scripture is full of stories. And again, the whole point of this sermon is just to convince you of the thesis that stories are powerful tools to communicate a message. And thus, we as Christians need to just watch them critically. You can't just sit there and just let it absorb into you. The same with me. You can't just let me just absorb into you. You know, you got it. Everything you hear, every message that comes to you has to be looked at critically. And so maybe then the question you're asking is, well, how do we look at these movies critically? That'll be next week. And I'll teach some tools about how you can actually properly watch a movie so that you can actually figure out what is the message it's trying to tell me. Now, let's get to these questions. Okay. Yes, that is my scarf, Peter. Scarf asked, yeah. Okay, next question. Are there any movies you think would be inappropriate for you to watch for Christians in general? This is a tough one. You know, when I was younger, the big thing was that we should just cut off all media from ourselves. And I'm not a big fan of that. Rather, I'm a big fan of watching movies critically. Right? I don't think you should watch, if you're going to watch a movie uncritically, you shouldn't watch anything, even if it's Bambi. Okay? If you're not going to watch Bambi critically, you probably shouldn't be watching it, because Bambi has a message. And if you're not aware of the messages that it's influencing you in, that's not good as a Christian believer. So if you're not going to watch movies critically, you shouldn't be watching movies at all. That's one thing I'll say. But don't get me wrong. Obviously, you want to get enjoyment of movies. You don't want to just do it as some research project, because then there's no fun in watching movies. I'm just saying, just be aware, right? But are there any movies you think are absolutely inappropriate? Well, I think this is often based on the person, but if you're watching a movie and you're noticing that you're starting to encompass some of the negative traits, some of the sinful patterns that exist in a movie, you should probably stop watching movies of that type. So if the movie is full of swearing, and then you're going out and you're swearing all the time, you should probably, clearly movies are influencing you in that way. You know, if you have troubles with lust and pornography, you probably shouldn't be watching shows that have lust and pornography all over them, right? If you're having trouble with, you know, I just need that one guy to love me. Oh, I just need that one guy to love me. If he loved me, my life would be perfect. If I just had that one guy, oh my goodness, my one guy. If that is your attitude, you should probably stop watching romantic comedies, right? Okay, so, yeah. So are there movies you shouldn't be watching? Yes, and how do you know? By being critical, by looking at what's in the movie, what's in your life. And if you're watching movies that are exemplifying the negative qualities in your life, you should probably cut those out. And I've had to do that. There are movies that I watch now that a few years ago I would have never watched because I was struggling in that area. And then there are movies in reverse, where I used to watch, but now I don't, because I realize they're negatively influencing me. And so this is something you have to do, because movies are very influential. I'll tell you that the movies are the number one thing that changes how we view the world. It's not school. The school plays a bit. School's probably number two. It's YouTube and videos and TV shows and all that. And then the final question was, there's two more questions. Wow. What's my view of Harry Potter? I love Harry Potter. But I realize that's controversial. Here's the thing. The reason why a lot of people aren't good with Harry Potter is because there's aspects in Harry Potter, like magic and witches and this, that, and the other thing, which would be considered anti-biblical. But here's the thing. If you're reading Harry Potter critically and pointing out, look, you know what, as Christians, we don't believe in magic, blah, 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 or things like that, then that's fine. But if you're just, here, read Harry Potter, child, and I'm going to walk away, and you can just, this is the gospel. If you're doing, that's, I think, kind of irresponsible. And you know what? I think Christians often play double standards on things like Harry Potter, because, you know, when the Chronicles of Narnia came out, Christians were all about the Chronicles of Narnia, and when Lord of the Rings came out, they were all about Lord of the Rings, and last time I checked, magic is oozing out of the pages of those books, though in a slightly different way. I think, though, when it comes to things like Harry Potter and these types of weird things, you want to be very careful that you're watching things critically. And this is really important. I myself just learned this danger very recently, because I like anime, and I showed my daughter the movie My Neighbor Totoro, which is it's a good children movie. But here's the thing. There's a lot of spiritual stuff in that movie that really encompasses Japanese spirituality with spirits and Shintoism and all this. And while I show my daughter Christian cartoons, she's not really grasping the points from those Christian cartoons. But she watches My Neighbor Totoro, and after that, she's like, "Daddy!" Or first, she went to mommy before, so daddy didn't know. Daddy found out from mommy. And Mark, our daughter says she wants to worship the spirits. Why would she want to be? Why is she saying that, Mark? I'm like, uh-oh. Right, here's the thing, because I uncritically showed her a movie that I liked when I was young, and I didn't really take the time to critically, you know, let my daughter know, and wasn't really even sure that she was prepared for something like that movie. And she's like, "Daddy, look, I'm worshiping. And I'm like, no, okay. Anyway, so here's the thing. So for parents here or future parents, you want to be careful what you show your kids. And I'm not saying hide your kids from stuff. But I'm saying, you know, make sure that if you're letting your kids watch stuff, that you're critically engaging with it and you're letting them know how it differs from how you think of things. And then the final question, wow, so many questions. Yes, and so someone wanted to just remind me that we don't only want to just watch things critically, but we want to watch things critically and compare it to, and this is what I meant, compare it to how it jives with the Christian worldview, right? So what's the worldview of this movie? What's the worldview of the Christian worldview? And how do they compare? Where do they contrast? Where do they agree? Yeah, and so any other questions? So hopefully, if I did my job today, I convinced you that movies are very powerful tools to convince you of things, and you need to watch them critically. I've probably said that 50 times. Yes. So we are now going to then go to the ultimate Christian symbol that is all over the New Testament, and that is the death and resurrection of Jesus and his sacrifice on the cross.